build a high-performing culture? This is Culture Architects. Candid conversations with extraordinary leaders sharing their biggest successes, failures, and lessons learned on their culture journeys. Here's David J. Friedman.
Welcome back to my conversation with Brad Whitchurch, the founder, CEO, and chairman of SealShield. In the first part of the interview, we talked about Brad's invention of the world's very first dishwasher-safe keyboard mouse, and how he laid the foundation of his present-day culture at SealShield. In this second part, we're going to go a lot deeper into that company culture, and particularly in the context of the pandemic. We'll also talk about the direction of SealShield for the foreseeable future.
So you start to refer to sometimes you've made mistakes like that. We all have. There's nobody that I always tell people recruiting, we're, no matter how good we are, we're never going to bat 1,000. We're going to make mistakes. And so you've from time to time, and you alluded to it, you've had to get rid of some people that maybe, pardon the language, they were assholes. And you realized they're just not the good fit. Shouldn't have hired this person. So one of the things I observe in so many leaders, and we've all been guilty of this, is we typically wait too long to get rid of one of those people. My experience is that anecdotally, so many of them tend to be salespeople where they're, you know, they produce a lot of business and they, you know, they have great customer relationships and some of our most important customers. And that's the excuse we use why we keep talking about the same person in every management meeting and we keep struggling with it and not making that decision to finally let them go. So when we finally do that, most people find that, you know, they're kicking themselves later thinking, darn, I should have done that a long time ago. So talk to me about, you know, you don't have to give me names, obviously, but like, who was the first person that you had that experience with where you realized that you're, in a sense, sending, you talked about the importance of consistency of messaging. When you allow one of those people to stick around, you're really sending a mixed message saying, you know, our culture is really important unless you produce enough business or unless you have technical capability or something else. So I'm sure you've had some of those. Talk to me about one of those.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, when you're a small company and you're juggling resources, everybody matters. So you're willing to overlook some of this really critical cultural components for the activity or the performance that you're getting out of that role. But if you're true to your values and your culture, as you said, it doesn't work. It makes, once you realize that any performance you're getting out of that individual who's culturally inadequate is offset by what's happening to the people around them, it becomes a lot easier to make those decisions. And we've been guilty of just what you said, where we've waited too long. You know, it's in every management meeting before we finally make the decision. And then what happens next? Everybody comes to you and says, well, it's about time. And, you know, that happens a couple of times and you start to get a little better at that process. And it's more obvious when we make that mistake now and we're able to take action quicker. And again, because it just hurts other people. So even if you're willing to put up with it, it's the damage to the others around them, the collateral damage that is just, it's unacceptable. And especially when you work so hard to hire great people and then you put them in a situation where they're diminished or they don't feel valued or they can't, you know, maximize their own potential. It's just defeatist. And you don't want to spend all this time and resources to get great people just to let them flounder in misery. It's not fair to them and it's not successful for the organization.
You know, I often talk about the unintended consequence of not dealing with that a-hole. That one of the unintended consequences, as you're referring to, is you put in jeopardy some of your very best people who are sitting on the sidelines thinking, is this the kind of place I want to work? If that stuff's acceptable here, do I want to be here?
That's right.
And you end up losing some of those key people.
That's right. And, you know, to that point, it really comes back to our values. And a lot of people have the values that they post on the wall or that they identify annually at their strategic planning session. And we were those people, too. We did a lot of kind of programs around defining our values and, hey, we want to have fun. And we'd have a list of, you know, hundreds of values. And ultimately, we were able to consolidate that down to just really four key values that now we've incorporated into so much of our organization. organization and we live by it. And coincidentally, and it is coincidentally, but very fortunately, our values make up the acronym ICEO. And that's really core to our beliefs that everyone has an ownership stake, an actual equity ownership stake in the company. We have up to 20% profit sharing. Everyone has the autonomy and the authority to manage the business from their piece of it the way they see fit. And that ICEO acronym stands for four things. It's integrity is first, customer obsession is second, employee empowerment and ownership thinking. And that really encompasses several hundred attributes that we find important in the organization. If we're operating with integrity, if we're focused on our customer through customer obsession, if we're true to our goals of employee empowerment resulting in ownership thinking, then that we will be successful if we focus on those four things. And we've taken it a step further. We've actually incorporated it into a rather novel best practice product development program. We use a program called V2MOM. And V2MOM puts values and vision at the front of the product development process. So why are we spending cycles to develop something only to come to the realization that it isn't consistent with our values and visions? So there's no point in embarking on a product development project if at first it doesn't meet our values, ICEO, and our vision to help prevent infections and save lives through data technology. So if it doesn't complete those two, there's no point in moving forward. And then, of course, the MOM is the methods, the obstacles, and the measurements that will make us successful in that process. But the point I'm making here is that, you know, we really utilize, we take to heart our values and our vision, and we incorporate it into our product development processes because it is so crucial to what it is that we want to accomplish at Seal Shield.
Great. So as systematic as you are with all of this, so clearly you're a systems kind of thinker, as am I. Talk to me about, so how do you incorporate those values into performance reviews? I'm one of your employees, I'm sitting with my manager, I'm going through a performance review. I'm sure you've built that into it some way. How does that happen?
Well, you know, we probably should have it built into the performance reviews. Okay. It is not a formal part of the performance reviews, but I'll tell you what we have done, David. Okay. We've incorporated a tool called Assembly, and Assembly is a peer recognition system, and all of our employees can go on to the Assembly platform, and every month our employees get 150, I'm embarrassed to say this, it wasn't my choice, but they're called Bradley Bucks. So every employee gets 150 Bradley Bucks every month that they can contribute to other employees, and they can only contribute up to a third of those. So, but they can recognize other employees for something they've done on the Assembly tool. And in the tool, you put what it is this employee did, how many Bradley Bucks you're contributing to them, and then the only other criteria is the drop down of ICEO, of our values. So it's something someone did, how it relates to our values, and then how many Bradley Bucks you want to contribute to them. And then it's a social media platform so other people see, oh, that is great. I'm going to throw Bradley Bucks on there too. Congratulations, so-and-so. Here's some Bradley Bucks. They build them up, and then the Bradley Bucks can be used for just about any major retail store that's through the program or for Seal Shield swag on our Seal Shield store. So people are able to accumulate some Bradley Bucks and reward themselves for the things that their peers have recognized them for as it ties specifically to those values.
Very nice. Very nice. So talk to me about, you know, you've done a lot of things that make a lot of sense. You've been very intentional, which is really what being a culture architect is about. It's about being intentional in creating your culture versus it letting it happen on its own. So what are the biggest mistakes you made along the way?
So I think one thing that we have to realize is that everyone is different. So it's not one size fits all. And as I said, when I started this company, I wanted to make a company that I wanted to work for. And a lot of these programs that we've talked about have stemmed from that. But what I found is that because everyone's different, you know, even with this framework, people have a tendency to kind of wander off in their own directions. All these programs are not a substitution for leadership. People still crave leadership. They still crave guidance and training and experience to help them on their journey. And, you know, just because you set up this fantastic framework, it doesn't work by itself. It's not a substitute for leadership. Mm. And so as leaders in the organization, we also have to participate. We have to continue to invest in ourselves so that we can be better, so that we can help our people be better and approach them with empathy and in a servant leadership mindset. So the framework is important, but it doesn't work alone. It's not a substitution for leadership.
You know, one of the things I've said to so many, and certainly it's been my experience, and it resonates with what you're saying, is that I say that the single most important ingredient in the success of any culture initiative is what I call CEO sponsorship. It starts with you. Doesn't mean you have to do it all, but if you don't have the passion that you so clearly do for driving this culture, if it was coming from the guy you mentioned, your IT guy slash HR person, if he went to Vistage and heard something, came back to you and said, Brad, I think this is something we ought to do. And you say, yeah, go ahead if you want. It's not going anywhere. You know, without your passion, your commitment at the very top, not much is going
to
happen.
Well, and to that point, David, it works the other way too. So we've had C-level guys, middle managers that you can tell, you know, they're not sure if they're buying into it. And, you know, then it's up to us to really be persistent and consistent. And then once they start drinking the Kool-Aid and you see that switch flip, that's what's really rewarding. When you can take someone who's like, I'm not so sure that jives with my experience, and then show them the path that's better and have them realize it for themselves, then you see them pick up the baton. And then they want to see what they can do to push that envelope up a little further, because, you know, doing right by people and helping them be their best, it's fun. And once you embrace these things and you have success with them, you crave more. And so really being able to see some of those managers and leaders who are like, I'm not so sure about this, when they come around, it's just so rewarding to see how they embrace it and the enjoyment they get out of helping other people be better using these kind of approaches.
Yeah. So let me switch gears a little bit, or switch direction. The pandemic happened. And one of the things that certainly, one of the many challenges of the pandemic was, as so many people started to work remotely, many companies who were proud of their cultures previously began to worry about, am I losing some of what made us special because a lot of our people aren't together anymore? So first question for you is, not understanding how your operation is set up fully, did you have a lot of people? Did you and do you have many people working remotely? Let me ask that question first. And then secondly, how has that affected you?
You know, I have an interesting perspective on this, David. Mm-hmm. When we started the company back in 2006, we were a rare, unheard of 100% virtual company back in 2006. So we started, we were developing best practices for Zoom before the masses were involved in this quarantine experiment, whatever you should call it. And so we'd already been through this learning curve, and we developed our own philosophies around it. And I have some terms that I've coined. You recognize what I call hermit syndrome. People get what I call hermit syndrome because they don't have that social aspect within the workplace. And because you're remote, you know, you don't run into someone in the office, you call somebody, they didn't call you back, your mind starts to play tricks on you. Oh, he's out to get me. Or why is he calling me back? He doesn't like me. And of course, it's all nonsense. It's the hermit syndrome. And it's because we don't have what I call water cooler sociology, where I forgot to call you back, but then I bump into you in the office, I say, oh, David, I'm so sorry, I completely forgot. Let's address your issue. And so really there's a lot of challenges to working remotely. And we found when we started hiring interns from the local university to do some work for us, that it was a real challenge for them to go home to their apartment that they shared with five other people and sit down in a quiet place and make their calls or do whatever work they had to do. And so we started an office really to help our young people. So they would have a place to go during the day to work. And what we found was that if we use that opportunity to be purposeful about building culture, that we could address some of these issues, the water cooler sociology, the hermit syndrome. And so we really embraced the opportunity to do fun things together when we were together. We kept expanding on that. And we go to football games together as a team. We go to concerts together, mm-hmm. basketball games. We race go-karts and throw axes. We do a lot of stuff together because we'd come from this place where we weren't together. And we treasured that time so much. And then, of course, come full circle, COVID comes around, and we have quarantine in place, and work from home becomes the norm. Well, we're very comfortable with that, but we have a little bit of a different perspective. So now, as people are, and as an urgent business during the pandemic, we were largely open when we didn't have to close okay. because of contact issues. But now we've embraced the work from home program moving forward. You know, I think some 30% of people say they'll never go back to the office, and a huge portion of people want some level of work from home. My philosophy is, I don't care where you work as long as you're productive. We want you to be happy, healthy, and productive. I don't want to give up creativity, camaraderie, and culture. So as long as we can be purposeful about giving people what they need in the work from home environment and be purposeful about what we do when we are in the office, then we can have success. And I think we've evolved into that. So currently, we've just expanded the work from home for our inside office people to 3 days a week. But Tuesday and Wednesday, everybody's in the office together. Okay. We experimented with staggered methods, but we've done some research, and based on our own experience, we believe that when we're all in the office together, that's when we get that creativity, collaboration, and culture build that gives us those credits for when we're working from home. And so we're very purposeful about those 2 days. We have the engineers in the office doing training. We have lunch and learns. We have a live podcast we film on those days. We do sales training. So all of the collaborative things we can do, we have our meals together, we break bread together, we spend as much quality time together as we can those 2 days a week in the office. And then we have the measurements in place to show the productivity, whether you're at home or in the office. And again, I don't care where you work from, as long as you're happy, healthy, productive, and we don't sacrifice collaboration, creativity, and culture. And I think we found that happy balance. And I know that a lot of other companies are looking for that balance. And those are the recommendations I would make. Have time in the office. When you're in the office, make sure that you're purposeful about the collaboration. And when you're out of the office, make sure you have the measurements for productivity that give you the confidence that things are operating the way you want them.
Makes sense. You know, it's interesting when you read the studies of people who say that they never want to go back to the office. They want to work from home forever. And what's interesting about that is, for many of them, if they went back to the office for a couple of days, they might end up saying, you know, I forgot. I like this.
Right.
It's just that we've forgotten how much we, even for me, I mean, my first company, I'm in my second company. My first company was a brick and mortar company. We were all there together, and I never would have imagined working from home. My second company, we've been remote from the very beginning, like you. And at the moment, I think, I don't know that I'd want to be in an office, but I suspect if we had an office, I mean, our people are all over the country, so it wouldn't be feasible for us. But if we had an office and I went there, I'd probably say, you know, I miss this. You know, there is something valuable about being there. And so you've got a good mix of the two.
Absolutely. And we're actually kind of bucked the trend. We've just upgraded our office. So while so many people are abandoning the offices, we moved into some fancy sweet new digs because we want it to be special. We want people to have the pride. We want people to enjoy coming to the office during those times when they're in the office. And so we've invested in that area.
That's great. So roll this picture forward a couple of years. So this is now, we're doing this interview right now in the fall of 2022. I roll this picture forward 3-4 years. It's 2025 or six. You and I are on a podcast like this. What does your company look like then, and what's different about it?
I think a lot's going to change. We're going to continue to grow. You know, COVID brought increased awareness to what we do as an infection control solutions provider. We certainly had tremendous growth in 2020 and 2021. We expect that growth to continue exponentially. We've got some new products coming out, and we're really focused on, over the next few years, expanding our vision beyond just our corporate culture and really being more of an influencer in the industry. Our industry, the infection prevention industry, has been highly fragmented a lot of emerging innovations. And really during COVID, it just gave the opportunity for people to say, if we collaborated, we may be able to solve some of these problems. And that's really the realization that when you talk about infection control, there's vectors of transmission. And like CS Shield, we've addressed the vector of transmission for dirty keyboards and mice. We have UV disinfection for mobile devices. We have UV resistant and chemical resistant screen protectors for medical equipment. But those are just three vectors. You have to address the air, you have to address the other hard surfaces, the floors, the furniture, all of these areas. But there are a finite number of vectors. So it's my vision that over the next 5 years, we'll really be able to collaborate and team up with some of the innovators in our space to create a suite of solutions that can impact a meaningful and measurable return on that investment. So we can have a really meaningful impact on cross-contamination transmissions, and that's our goal, that to develop new solutions ourselves, but also to partner with the broader community to have a united front so that we can actually solve some of these pathogen problems in the future.
Mm-hmm. That's great. All right, last question for you. So you're in your Vistage meeting. You're still in Vistage, by the way?
Oh, yes. Over 15 years.
All right, great. So you're in your Vistage meeting. A new member comes in. He or she is a young CEO. They're 29, 30 years old, and they're trying to build their business. And they look at you and the success you've had, and they ask you, Brad, so what's your number one piece of advice? I'm a 30-year-old CEO in your Vistage meeting. What's your number one piece of advice for me about building culture as a culture architect?
It's really simple. It's all about the people. And once you have that basic philosophy that it's all about the people, then you find you're getting creative in ways to help take care of the people. And then you find that it becomes a two-way street and they're taking care of you too. It's really a process that comes down to the very simple statement, it's all about the people. People first.
Mm-hmm. And just making that a priority.
Absolutely.
Fascinating. Well, Brad, I really appreciate you spending time with us. You are truly a culture architect.
Thank you, Dave.
We talk about culture architecture, we're talking about people like Brad who understand that it's all about the people, and not just understand it, but have taken specific actions to very intentionally and systematically create winning cultures. So, Brad, once again, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, David. It's been a real pleasure to be on your show.
Thanks.
And that's it for this episode of Culture Architects with my fellow culture architect, Brad Whitchurch, the founder, CEO, and chairman of Seal Shield. If you're really enjoying this show, make sure you take a second to subscribe, and that way you'll automatically get my new shows as soon as they drop. Also, if you have a minute, I'd love it if you left us a review, and that way more folks like you can discover the show. I'll see you next time on Culture Architects.
This has been Culture Architects with David J. Friedman. Join us next time for more insights and wisdom from great leaders in all walks of life. To book David for your next event or to learn more about his writing, speaking, or consulting, go to davidjfriedman.com. Culture Architects with David J. Friedman is a production of CultureWise.